From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear from Preston Cole, the secretary designee for Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. Then we discuss the book An American Summer and the PTSD symptoms caused by living in neighborhoods plagued with gun violence.
There's nothing posted about it because they experience the violence, they lose a loved one, they're a witness to an act of brutality, and yet there's no safety, there's no place of respite. They are still looking over their shoulder for what's going to happen next.
And a man incarcerated in the Wisconsin prison system is about to receive a gallery show featuring his miniature abstract paintings.
All those years, I knew him only as a pleasant guy, very serious about his Buddhist practice. I had no idea that behind this very pleasant guy was a major artist.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Preston Cole is one step away from officially heading the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. While Cole waits for the state Senate to vote on his assignment, the secretary designee says there's no time to waste when it comes to tackling the state's environmental issues, from chronic wasting disease to a myriad of drinking water concerns. Lake Effect's Susan Benz caught up with Cole last Friday at the state fair and asked him about one of the drinking water issues facing some areas of Wisconsin called PFAS.
PFAS is a group of chemicals that have been on our landscape for a long period of time because they're part of our manufacturing processes, from Teflon to Scotchgard, those types of products, which serve us well, quite frankly, can find their way into streams, water, groundwater, surface water, drinking water, and it provides issues and problems for those who ingest that. And so what we're attempting to do is create the rulemaking process about drinking water and how many parts per trillion is okay for human consumption. And so we're beginning that process. It's about a 30-month process. We work with our professionals at the Department of Health Services because they are the arbiter of good health, and we're following their lead. And so what we have to do now is begin that rulemaking process. And so everybody's in the pool as it relates to it. So we'll be hearing from corporations and nonprofits, people concerned about drinking water, people who want to make sure that there's a balancing act between how we move on these types of initiatives. I think it'll be a robust conversation about what I call some of the more insidious types of chemicals, these legacy chemicals. They bioaccumulate in our bodies, and I think people will have a lot to say about it.
Robust discussion, yes, but we need action.
And again, the rulemaking process is beginning, and that's where that action starts.
You're not out there working solo. You have the legislature, you have the governor, you have the Natural Resources Board. So mm-hmm. Can you sort of maybe, even through an example, maybe through PFAS, what will it take to make that all happen?
So that rulemaking process, once it concludes, that rule will then go to the Natural Resources Board for codification and then forward it on to the legislature and then to the governors for signing. There's a lot of research that's going to be done. There's going to be numerous public and involvement sessions. We'll get to hear from everyone. And as the regulator of groundwater, drinking water, and surface water, the role of the DNR is to move that new rule into place so that we then know what the implications are for human consumption. And that's important for us. And so, again, the DNR regulates groundwater and surface water and drinking water. And as a regulator, we have the role and responsibility to ensure that this gets done.
Back to the PFAS. If that rulemaking all comes together, would Wisconsin have that framework before the EPA does? I mean, I know you said they're doing research, but there's no regulation around PFAS right now at a federal level. Is that correct?
That's correct. While the EPA does not have a codified rule on drinking water, groundwater, we've moved to this idea of what it should be. And many states have lower levels than we do on groundwater or drinking water. But the EPA has moved away from codifying those. They're leaving it up to the states. And so what you're going to have is a quilt work patch around drinking water, groundwater, and surface water that are going to be in play. And if that doesn't concern us, it should, because there's you can't have that kind of differential standards for the waters of your state have vast differences around consumption. And so my hope is that there will be actions from the EPA at some point. Standing down on this is just isn't smart. We need their assistance to codify some of these rules and put it in play, and then we can act accordingly as it relates to the Clean Water Act, and we can act in unison around this country versus this quilt work hodgepodge. Some will have none, some will have high levels, some will have medium levels. That's a problem. It's simply just a problem.
You've had unique experiences. You were the head of and served on the Natural Resources mm-hmm. Board. You started your career in forestry, mm-hmm. right? So coming into your job now at this magical time you're saying, what do you see as the importance of the role the DNR is playing?
Well, again, we are everything from economic development to where cities, towns, and villages want their boardwalks and restaurants and nightlife associated with lakes and rivers. Our role there is, you know, if they have contaminated sediment, we give funds and money to remove that contaminated sediment. The role that we have as regulator in terms of environmental protections, what comes out of the end of a pipe from a manufacturing plant, cheese making, to what comes out of the top of a stack for manufacturers as well. So clean air, clean water, the Clean Air Act, we manage that, and the Clean Water Act as well. But we have a robust relationship in forestry, fisheries, and wildlife, and outdoor recreation. Outdoor recreation in the state of Wisconsin is an $18 billion industry, and people make their way to Wisconsin for the traditions of hunting and fishing and visiting our state parks. Family values and the economy associated with hunting and fishing is a big deal. And again, this simple act of planting trees and providing environmental protection, outdoor recreation. We have a robust forestry economy here that the state, local municipalities, county forest associations, U.S. Forest Service, you know, there's 10 counties in the state of Wisconsin where the number one employer are forestry-related industries. It's a 60,000 job, industry in the state of Wisconsin. And quite frankly, it's been our legacy over a millennia in terms of wood products in the state of Wisconsin. So environmental protection, outdoor recreation, are essential in the state of Wisconsin. And our role is to ensure those opportunities get provided and environmental protection is at the foremost of all of that. Because if the environment in which you operate it has tainted water or bad air, then we won't have a robust fishing economy. We won't have a robust forestry economy. We won't have a robust state park economy if our environment is upside down.
So is the DNR currently equipped staff-wise and scientist-wise to do the job it needs to do?
Well, we certainly ask for, you know, additional scientists to work on PFAS. We get two of those. We also have our regulatory model around combined animal feeding operations, CAFOs. The legislature reauthorized positions that we already have to work on those types of things. We're certainly going to need more scientists to work on it. And the reason is that I've made my way to the EPA laboratory in Cincinnati to see how the researchers and the scientists there were able to predict where PFAS is. And so I talked to them at length, and their testing protocols are stellar. I mean, this is what we'll be using to determine where this chemical is. But they're also working on lead pipes, you know, technologies around lead pipes, around, you know, flow molds that can go in and give short-term relief to families around lead laterals. So the EPA, as a regulator itself, has a robust, research program. And so what we're trying to do is emulate some of their protocols. I'm excited to know that we have additional resources associated with clean water. We have $35.5 million associated with contaminated sediments. Removal, well cap programs, and that's, you know, there's about 800,000 wells in the state of Wisconsin that support 1.7 million people. And the testing protocols are there, but people just aren't testing them. And we ask people to test those at least once a year. But we have no authority over private wells. And we know that those private wells need help. They are corroding, they're aging, and folks may not have, rural Wisconsin may not have the requisite resources to do those tests every year. So we'd like to continue to have that conversation about, you know, where we're equipped and where we're not equipped and where our authority begins and ends. But what we're advocating for is testing. And if that means that through the Year of Clean Drinking Water and the Mr. Voss's task force, that what comes out of this is to develop some protocols for well testing, because people need to know what they're drinking. And sometimes they move
away. An affordable way to have that testing done?
Absolutely. I think that it has to be affordable if we want to ensure clean drinking water, if people want clean drinking water. I mean, families are in dire straits, you know, especially where the underlayment, that soil, is in slurry and bedrock, which is like Swiss cheese, and you got leaky septic systems in the Kewaunee County area, 15 counties that have that bedrock making its way down to the southwest in Iowa and Grant County and Lafayette County. And so we know too much not to move in the right direction.
Recently, you and the governor spoke about lead in water, the lead contamination concern and issue. Where does that stand in terms of policy and what you hope will come out of it?
Well, the $40 million lead lateral program was struck from the budget, and I believe the governor has reintroduced a new bill to bring that $40 million back for consideration, which is legislature. Look, there are 300 cities, towns, and villages with lead laterals. While people want to focus on, you know, Milwaukee, I mean, lead laterals go, I run from Milwaukee to Racine all the way up to Duluth Superior. And these outdated form of moving water into homes put people in harm's way. Pregnant women, children of the age of 6 are in harm's way from lead in water. We know that there are serious developmental issues for children around lead in their drinking water. And again, you'll always hear me say this. We know too much about what harms that these types of infrastructure does to people. We should be smart about how we go about addressing it. And the way we go about addressing it is putting the requisite resources in place for cities, towns, and villages to begin the process. We have to move, and we have to move quickly. You know, and so, you know, time is of the essence. How many families are in harm's way from lead drinking water? And it's that should be the driving force. It's just we can't allow this type of damage for our youngest, most vulnerable citizens to keep going. We just have to recognize we have to move, and we have to move and act now. Not tomorrow, but now. And that $40 million bill will hit the legislature, and they'll have to deal with that on its face.
You do have a tough job, though.
A lot of responsibility. Very tough.
What gets you up and moving each day and saying, okay, here I go with another meeting, here I go with another message around clean drinking water?
I have the best job. While my secretaries say that they have the best job, my colleagues, look, we know that the Department of Natural Resources touches every segment of our society, from government organizations to private industry, outdoor recreation enthusiasts, hunters, fishermen, and the ordinary citizens who turn their tap on and want clean water. That role I take very seriously, but it is the best job that I have. I think the time that I've served on the Natural Resources Board, those 12 years helped me prepare for this job, not knowing that this job would ever come. But certainly the rulemaking process and all those rules that came before us has allowed me to, you know, hearken in and usher in a new era for the DNR in terms of our roles and responsibilities. And I have to look around the corner. I have to see what's coming at us. And I have to have staff that's able to see around the corner. We have a robust employee base. We have great partnerships with our partner agencies. We have great relationships with our, you know, friends groups and natural resource organizations. And I think that what I'm realizing is there is a large chorus of people and organizations that not only wish us success, but want to lend a helping hand. And that's important for us, that we may not have all the answers. There's other researchers that are working on other kinds of things that bring us information. But I think that helping hand from, provides us an opportunity to sit at a table and agree to disagree on occasion, but collaborate most often. And that relationship with the public is important for me, and important for me when I was on the DNR board, that seven-member board has been around on this landscape as part of Wisconsin's history, and it will continue to last for another 100 or so years and going forward. But it's the simple act of listening to, you know, folks from Kewaunee County, folks who come to us with problems. And so I'm excited about it. I'm excited about the relationships we have with the public, our natural resource organizations around the state. And I get up every day, big smile on my face, and let's go get them.
That was Wisconsin DNR Secretary Designee Preston Cole speaking with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz. The Speaker's Task Force on Water Quality is holding public hearings around the state. You'll find information about the group at WUWM.com. You can also find more information on Preston Cole's memories of proudly serving as Smokey the Bear. Coming up, journalist and author Alex Kotlowitz talks with us about his newest book, An American Summer. It looks at the impact of gun violence and how it's transforming city neighborhoods. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When Alex Kotlowitz's book, There Are No Children Here, first came out in 1992, the country was facing unprecedented violence. Homicides in the nation's largest cities were at an all-time high, triggered by gangs and a drug trade that dominated many of the country's poorest neighborhoods. His book was set in the Henry Horner Homes, a public housing project on the west side of Chicago. But much has changed over the last decades. The Henry Horner Homes, as well as many other public housing projects in Chicago, were torn down. The gangs that once ruled these areas were similarly demolished, as gang leaders were jailed with hefty sentences. Violence decreased, but it didn't vanish. Kotlowitz's newest book is called An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. It tells 14 stories about loss, family, and survival. Kotlowitz was in Milwaukee earlier this year for an event at Boswell Book Company, but he joined us by phone beforehand. Alex, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, I have to say, writing questions for this interview was really difficult. It's hard to find a place to begin, in part because I don't think anyone can read this book and not feel like these conversations are a little insufficient. Right? Insufficient in some way. But I'd like to start here. Why did you write this book? Why right now?
In some ways, this book is kind of a bookend to my first book, There Are No Children Here, which came out some 28 years ago. And one of the things that knocked me off balance when I was working on that book was the just pervasiveness of the violence in the community I was writing about. You know, I was following two young boys in a public housing complex. And I have been really distressed and sobered by the stubborn persistence of the violence. And my feeling over the years is that we've completely underestimated the impact of the violence on the spirit of both individuals and the spirit of community. And that's what I wanted to try to get at in this book and these very intimate stories.
You know, one of the things the book talks about is PTSD. And it's one of those things that you go, it's not quite the right word because it's never post.
Right. You know, there's a conversation among social workers who work in these communities, and I certainly saw it in the people that I spent time with. You know, they have a lot of the same symptoms that combat veterans had returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they're easy to anger, they have trouble concentrating, they're self-medicating by smoking marijuana or drinking, trouble sleeping, just anxious all the time. But as you suggest, while they have the same symptoms of those who've experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, there's nothing post about it because they experience the violence, they lose a loved one, they're a witness to an act of brutality, and yet there's no safety, there's no place of respite. They are still looking over their shoulder for what's going to happen next. And so social workers have this informal term in these communities, it's what they call complex loss, the idea that you may lose someone close to you, but then have to reckon with what lies ahead.
There's so many different coping mechanisms that are on display in this book, and I'd like to get back to that, but to kind of go back in Chicago's history, because we tend to talk about violence in Chicago as though it's still kind of the 1990s, as though it has these mechanisms that are in some ways no longer there. So how have things changed in Chicago since you wrote There Are No Children Here?
Sure. Well, the two most notable things that have changed is as bad as the violence is now, and it is really bad, it was actually worse some 28 years ago. Though I will say the numbers in the past couple of years have approached the numbers of the 1990s again, which has been really disturbing and unsettling. But the other part that's changed considerably is back in the early 90s, the gangs were organized around the drug trade. And so the violence was much more directed. It was usually over controlling their turf or their terrain. And in the late 1990s, the law enforcement agencies went after the heads of the snake. They went and arrested many of the gang leaders in the city. And as a result, the gangs began to fall apart. And now, you know, the police estimate there are now 600 to 800 different cliques or crews around the city, organized block by block. They're not organized around the drug trade. The violence feels more arbitrary. It feels more petty, that somebody's been disrespected in some manner, and it feels much more unpredictable.
You mentioned cliques, of course, and in the book you speak with someone who was the head of a gang in Chicago, and something that he talks about is exactly what you mentioned, how arbitrary the violence has become. When you're talking about these cliques, it seems as though everyone in the book is part of something, that it's kind of unavoidable.
Well, it's hard if you're young, especially a young man growing up in these communities, just by the nature of where you live, not to belong to one of these organizations. And I think one of the things that was clear to me, and you see it in some of the stories in the book, is that often when the newspapers or the police report on an act of violence, the first thing that they describe about the victim is the fact that they were a gang member, as if that somehow is what defines them. And as a result, people, loved ones, are, you know, their immediate stance in the wake of losing someone is to defend them, because there's this kind of notion out there, I think, that what goes around comes around.
One of the things the book really does is it does humanize people. You know, you read headlines, especially if you're in the city of Chicago or if you're in a city like Milwaukee, honestly, and it is very matter of fact. This person was shot. It was at this corner, and this is their criminal record. But there is so much more to that person. And the interesting part of it is, of your book, is that you not only humanize the victims, but you also humanize the perpetrators.
What I wanted to do in this book, I was looking for, you know, the book is, it takes place over the course of this one summer. It's a collection of 14 stories. Some of them course through the summer, some are self-contained. And I was looking for stories that upended my thinking, that challenged my own sort of presuppositions and assumptions. And what I wanted to write, I wanted, you know, the kind of centripetal force of storytelling is empathy, this idea of trying to imagine yourself as others. And I wanted to try to write this book without judging, but really trying to understand. So the stories really vary. And as you mentioned, one of the stories is about a gentleman who, at the age of 18, in an act of vengeance, one of his friends has been shot and paralyzed, goes out and kills a rival gang member, and he ends up serving 14 years in prison. And Eddie Bocanegra, his story is really a story about trying to forgive yourself for what you've done. And Eddie, as an adult, has devoted every minute of his life to trying to undo some of the damage that he helped cause when he was younger. He's, you know, working in violence prevention. He's mentoring young people. I mean, just an extraordinary individual. But the story itself is Eddie's still trying to find a way to forgive himself for what he had done.
One of the stories that stuck out to me was the mother of a man who was shot by another man in a situation that it seemed like no one really came in with good mm-hmm. intentions.
Right.
And it really highlighted how people can end up really on either side of that right. equation.
Right. No, the lines are often blurred. I mean, the story you talk about is a story of this extraordinary woman, Lisa Daniels, a single mom. Her older son is an engineering student at University of Illinois, and her younger son, Darren, he wanders, he strays, he gets involved in dealing drugs. Lisa does everything she can to hold him close. And then one day he goes to buy some drugs, a small amount of marijuana. It appears that he had all intentions of robbing the drug dealer, and that the drug dealer may have had all intentions of robbing him. And a shootout erupts, and Darren is killed. And so two things happen. One is that the local newspaper runs a story about Darren's death, and all it talks about is his criminal record. He had spent some time in prison, and Lisa, his mother, she wasn't in denial. She knew exactly her son's history. She knew what her son had done, but she knew there was so much more to Darren. And so she made it a point to letting people know that her son was a much richer, complicated human being than the authorities would lead you to believe. And in fact, she got on her license plate, on the frame of her license plate, it reads, "I had a son, his name was Darren." But the other remarkable thing about Lisa is, you know, she assumes that the person who killed him is going to go to away prison for a long time. It seems like a kind of open and shut case. But as it turns out, the witness to the shooting had a criminal record and made for a suspect witness. And so the state's attorney decides that they want to offer a plea deal. And Lisa says, okay, but I have one request, and I want to give a victim impact statement at the sentencing. And usually victim impact statements are about the impact the death of the loved one has had on you and your family. And so Lisa gets up in the courtroom, and she talks a little bit about that. But then she gives this remarkable talk where she asks for leniency, where she forgives the person who shot her son. And in fact, to this day, she's got a correspondence with the young man who's now serving time in prison.
Her story is so remarkable, I think in part because many of us, although we want to believe we would be like her, I think many of us know that maybe we couldn't.
It is really hard, and I think to be fair, and I really want to be careful about this, and Lisa knows this, is that there are instances where forgiveness is really, really hard, if not impossible, when there's no sense of remorse on the part of the individual who had done the shooting. But go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No problem. But one of the things I was about to ask is there are a lot of different coping mechanisms, but also just responses to the violence that people mm-hmm. see, that they experience. What are some of the ways that people deal with this onslaught of violence?
You know, the thing for me that was notable among most of the people I spent time with is they hold on to their feelings and their experiences really tightly. Not only are they not encouraged from talking about it, but sometimes discouraged out of fear that if they do, they'll be held culpable for the crime. And so for many of the people I spent time with, it was the first time they spoke about their loss, about what they were going through. I mean, there's this kind of utter sense of loneliness. And that, you know, that grief, that trauma can take a toll on individuals. You know, people look for solace in all different manners and ways. You know, many of the mothers who grieve in Chicago, they form support groups amongst each other. After a shooting in the city, these shrines arise, you know, flowers and balloons, you know, and in the summer, they're kind of, you can find them virtually everywhere. So people have all these different ways of managing. And I think, you know, the truth of the matter is, I think by telling stories is what, there's a great line in Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, where he writes, you know, it's this novel about, loosely based on his experience in Vietnam, where he writes, you know, this much is true, stories can save us. And I think what O'Brien was saying is that if we can tell our stories, if we can share our stories, that's what ultimately will connect us, will make us feel less alone.
Well, and with that thought, you know, these stories are in some ways very uniquely Chicago. But you didn't title the book a Chicago summer. You titled it An American Summer. And of course, these stories are very familiar here in Milwaukee. You know, what are the elements of these stories that are universal and really speak to the violence that we're seeing throughout the country?
Right. Well, I titled it that way for two reasons. One is that, you know, you're right. The book takes place in Chicago. It just as easily could have taken place in Milwaukee and in Detroit and Philadelphia, Baltimore. I mean, there's so many cities that are experiencing this. But moreover, you know, we're a country that's been racked by gun violence. And what's notable to me is that in the wake of the tragic shootings in Newtown and then Parkland, we asked all the right questions. You know, well, what brought this young man to do what he did? How do these individuals in this community emerge with all that's bearing down on them? We don't ask those questions in places like Chicago or Milwaukee or Detroit or Baltimore. And we need to start asking those questions.
What do you hope people take away from this book? People who might not know anything about the city of Chicago, who may have a lot of misconceptions about what gun violence looks like.
Yeah. And again, I don't see this book as a book about Chicago. I feel like it's really a book about the kind of soul of our country. And what I want people to come to understand is that in some ways, the book is a kind of rallying cry that we need to begin really sort of figuring out what we can do. And I think the one commonality you'll see in all the neighborhoods in Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Baltimore, where the violence is so pervasive, is that these are communities that are deeply distressed. And in some ways, this seems so self-evident, I even hesitate to say it aloud, but we need to find ways to rebuild and refortify community. And so given how self-evident it is, the question I ask is, where's everyone been? You know, for me, I tell stories, my ambitions are reasonably modest, is I tell stories to introduce readers to communities they otherwise wouldn't venture to introduce them to people they otherwise wouldn't meet. And my hope is that when you put down this book, that you'll look at yourself and the world just a little bit differently.
I think that's a very modest hope there, and something that I don't think anyone could pick up this book and not think differently.
Well, thanks.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with me.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alex Kotlowitz is a journalist and the author of An American Summer, Love and Death in Chicago. He first spoke with us in March. We'll take one last break and then learn about the unusual artist whose work is on view at Milwaukee's Portrait Society Gallery. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Art and the people who make it are often found on the margins of society. In the case of painter M. Winston, those margins include a cell and guards. Mr. Winston is incarcerated, and it was just an accident that his work, miniature abstract paintings, was discovered. And while he can't attend, his work is getting a full gallery show in the Third Ward. The exhibit called Inside Out opens this Friday, and since we couldn't speak with Mr. Winston, we decided to invite his Buddhist teacher to talk in his place. Tonin O'Connor is no stranger to Milwaukee. For 21 years, he was the managing director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater and was also the head priest at the Milwaukee Zen Center for a decade. She began the center's prison ministry in the late 90s, and through that work met M. Winston and learned about his art. O'Connor gives Lake Effect's Bonnie North the details.
M. Winston is currently incarcerated in one of the state prisons. I've known him for probably 10 years because between 17 years following 1998, I was going inside actually many different prisons to offer Buddhist programming. And Winston, Mr. Winston, was part of one of my groups. After I stopped going inside, I continued to be in contact with him because he writes occasionally for a quarterly newsletter of inmate writing that the Milwaukee Zen Center publishes. And occasionally he would write me about Zen matters or, you know, Buddhist questions. And I haven't actually seen him probably in, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 years, but we've remained in contact. All those years, I knew him only as a pleasant guy, very serious about his Buddhist practice, you know, good in coming to groups and whatnot. And I know from his current teacher that that's true as well, and they have pastoral visits and things. I had no idea that behind this very pleasant guy, who's now, I think, about 55, was a major artist. And I don't think I would have known, despite all of the, you know, contact over the years with him and with his teacher and with other inmates, if he hadn't elected at the prison he's at to, I think, just to be helpful, posted a couple of his small paintings on a job, some sort of a notice about a job fair that was coming. Well, the officers and the staff saw them and were electrified. He tells a wonderful story about one of the, they call them white shirts, but one of the correctional officers, you know, came to his cell and said, "What is this? This is wonderful. And do you do it all the time?" And he pulled out, he has a notebook that he's been keeping for years and years and years. He's been doing this since he was a child, with over 600 of these miniature abstract paintings.
And I was going to say, we have to say that they are small.
They're very small. They run from maybe an inch by 2 inches to maybe
3 by 3.
Three by three, perhaps. Some are rectangular, some are square. But they're very small. And at the same time, they have extraordinary depth. But anyway, what happened was the correctional officer, you know, kind of spread the word, and he was then was brought into the prison library, where the librarian got very, very excited. One of the officers had brought in a book of illustrations of an artist named Pat Pasloff. She was Milton Resnick's partner and did abstract work in the 50s. And I got this letter from Mr. Winston saying, and she said, "My work was better." They liked it better. So what I'm trying to emphasize here is how supportive the prison staff have been of suddenly his emergence as an artist.
Even though he's been doing this, he's 55 and he's been doing this since he was a child, I'm assuming he's self-taught?
As far as I know, he is self-taught. He talks about doing art in school. He was very proud of the fact he grew up in Mississippi, but he was asked to draw, you know, pictures of presidents for President's Day on the high school hallway and stuff. But he says something interesting, that for quite a long time he sort of did what other people wanted him, you know, to do. And then he went back to what he really loves is abstract. So that the way he presents his vision of a place or a happening is abstract. And at the same time, what has struck me is that you can see the places. I mean, they will be named Paris, London, New Mexico, Dawn, Western Australia. And you look at them and you think, holy smoke, there it is, you know, although they're abstract.
The thing I noticed looking, you have you have some selections here that you brought with you, is just sitting across from them here in the studio, there's so much color. He's a colorist.
He's a colorist.
And it's gorgeous stuff.
Yeah. Well, and some of them, you know, they're not all, these are quite brilliant, some are quite dark, but his handling of color relationships and suggestions of space and distance are really, to me, quite stunning. And as I was telling you before we started, what happened to me was that because there was this excitement, you know, where he is, he sent me a letter. And I opened the letter and out fell 3 or 4 of these tiny paintings onto my desk. And I looked at them and I have to tell you, the mental response was sort of, holy smoke, this is the real thing. This is the real thing. And somebody said to me once, well, how do you know it's the real thing? And I got kind of huffy and said, well, in 1954, which is, of course, 65 years ago, I graduated from Swarthmore College with a degree, a bachelor's degree, with high honors in art history. Now, I didn't use it. I ran off into the theater and then I've had 20 years of work, you know, as a Zen teacher. But somehow you get trained to see things if you're going to really spend all your time looking at art of various kinds.
Well, and that also works with Buddhism too, because my understanding is noticing.
Buddhism is about awareness, basic awareness. And there are two things about it. One is to see, really see. And this certainly has affected all those years. For 17 years, I was going inside the prison system, and I'm very sorry now that I've gotten so old I can't make the long drives because I miss it terribly. But what Buddhism does, it says, look at people. See them as they are. Don't make snap judgments. Don't, in this case, be affected by the fact that they all wear a little driver's license-sized card around their neck that says offender on it. Don't worry about the mistakes they made that brought them here, because this is now. This is what we're doing. And I met extraordinary people who were really making an effort to alter the way they saw things and the way their lives were going to be lived. And some of them I still know who are still inside, and yet they've made real contributions to the life of inside. You know, it's a life. It's not necessarily just this time before you get out. It's also, it can be, if you're in for a very long sentence, a very long, it's your life. But the other thing between awareness is empathy. And people used to ask me when I worked in the theater, well, what a weird, you know, they thought it was weird that I made the shift to Buddhism. I said, not in the least, because Buddhism is about interdependence and compassion. And for me, theater has always been about creating situations in which people can have empathy for people, for situations they would never personally encounter. You know, maybe thousands of years ago, maybe another country, maybe the kind of person they will never meet. So to me, the transition into Buddhist study and teaching was absolutely natural. And what I like about M. Winston's work is that there is such a sense of connection with place, although it's abstract. But I think over the years, he just gave it away, you know, or kept it. This size is the style he loves and he's best at, I think. I've seen some of the larger ones. They're okay. This stuff, these miniatures
this
are brilliant.
This is his sweet spot.
This is it, you know. Yeah. But also because within the prisons, there are actually art programs called Hobby in most of the prisons with teachers and so on. In fact, I know one inmate in for life who has become a master cabinet maker, you know, due to training in prison. But if you make something in Hobby, as they call it, that is, let's say, 8.5 by 11 or larger, you have to send it out to family. You cannot keep it. But these little tiny paintings that are his meditation have just gone into a notebook, you know.
Well, you just said something very interesting, mm-hmm. that he considers this his meditation.
Yes, he does.
This is a meditative practice.
It's a meditative practice for him. In fact, I had a funny letter from him sort of joking and saying, you know, I opened my big mouth and told her why I did it, because it's a kind of private matter. He told the officer, you know, but that he does it as a form of meditation. The group of paintings that I brought in are called Nirvana series, so they directly have to do with his practice. That's not true for, I would say, the bulk of what he does. It's just his response to things, and interestingly enough, often places he has never seen except through television or movies or something, and yet there's a kind of remarkable sense of place in the miniatures.
How do you think his Buddhist practice has informed his art? Do you think it would look different if he was not a practicing Buddhist?
I really can't say. I don't know. I think it's almost the other way around, that the art is a meditation that assists the Buddhist practice. I mean, I know he studied quite a long time. I know that he does what we would call ordinary meditation, Zazen, and he attends the Buddhist group that's being led at the prison he's in. But I honestly don't know. I do think that anything that requires or asks of us total absorption is a meditation that is very close to what Buddhism is suggesting we can do with each moment of our life. You know, be free of all the bedeviling other worries and things, because I'm doing this. And I think, you know, people recognize it. They recognize it in baseball players. You know, they're always talking about finding the zone, or you can do it if you're reading a book. But it has to do with nothing else really disturbs that moment. So I think that for him, you know, prison is
the cacophony, the noise, the hostility, the negativity is powerful. And our prisons are very overcrowded, which means that it's terribly tough on every inmate and terribly tough on every guard, for that matter. So that to be able to concentrate and paint these little wonderful little paintings, I think, is a kind of way to take yourself away from all that.
I was going
to
say a refuge.
It's a refuge, really.
Yeah.
Really a refuge. But I think, I don't know, I'm not a painter. I've done some writing, but anything creative is a kind of refuge. You know, whether you're in prison or you're working in a corporate office, it doesn't...
Which some people would say would be in
prison. I understand that some of them... That some I said that and then I thought, oops, well...
Yeah, well, a different kind of prison. Yeah,
a different kind. And it is true that one of the major understandings of Buddhism is that, you know, we are imprisoned by our own mind's illusions about how things are. So we would say that being in a physical prison is no barrier or no better or no worse than me sitting here talking to you to freeing myself from the mess in my head, if you will, you know, all my misconceptions and all my misunderstandings and achieving some kind of clarity. But I certainly think that I'm hopeful. There's a considerable movement going on here in Wisconsin now under an organization called Wisdom. I don't really know anything about them, but Wisdom has chapters all over the state that are trying to have a positive effect on a whole host of things that are wrong with our current system of incarceration. And I'm hopeful that finally that will begin to have some effect.
Do you think that showing work like this to the public that would not normally even associate art with prison in any way, shape, or form, do you think that will help?
I think so, because one of the problems we have is that, and I'm going to make a generalization here, but that the average person thinks of criminals, thugs, put them away, never let them out. They're dangerous, forgetting that the majority of them will get out. And that a system whose purpose is largely to either warehouse or punish will not make them better. It may even make them worse. So that for our own welfare and our society's welfare, we need prisons that are not so crowded, where there's better programming. I will say the people I've known inside who are offering programming are working their heads off. I mean, they're doing the very best they can. But often the lines are very long. You know, if there's a course in computer use, you may have to wait 6 months to, you know, you're in line for it, that because they don't have the space or the people. But I think if people can begin to understand that those who are in prison, those who wear that tag offender, are people. They're people like the people you pass in the corridor at work. They're no different. They've made some of them hideous mistakes, but they're all human beings with different backgrounds, many of them having grown up in horrifying circumstances and gotten their whole approach to life pretty twisted by it. I'm not saying they're victims, because many of them are victimizers, but it seems to me that anything that can be done to say we have put away and are not assisting people who could be valuable to our society is really important. And seeing artwork like this, I know another Buddhist teacher from Madison who's talking about the fact that he and some other people are publishing a book of poetry by a man who actually was in Boscobel for years, to suggest that just lumping them all together and thinking we've done our job when we put them away and then we would like to punish them the whole time they're there, I think you have to understand that being in prison is punishment, period. Even if the situation, you know, the conditions were better than they are today. But when you then say that you're in prison to be constantly punished and we never want to see you again, we're wasting talent, we're wasting resources, we're spending far too much money. I mean, people are always, you know, they howl about their taxes. Well, let me tell you, an enormous amount of our taxes are going to support a prison system. We have, I think, 22 or 23,000 inmates in prison here in Wisconsin. I have a friend in Iowa who is a Buddhist teacher who also goes into the Iowa prison system. They have 8,000. And I don't know, Minnesota is significantly less, right next door. So something has been happening in this state, and a lot of it is racism, because compared to the percentage of population people of color occupy, the percentage in prison is enormous. You are far more likely.
It's like reversed.
It's like reversed. Yeah. You know, you're far more likely to go into prison if you're African American or Latino or Asian than if you're white for the same crime. I think it might be important to know that Mr. Winston is African American and a brilliant artist. What else can I say?
Has he said what he hopes comes out of this exhibition for himself?
He is so surprised by the whole thing. And I'm a little surprised and excited because, you know, there I was, yes, an old theater person, yes, a Zen teacher, but sitting with little paintings on my desk. And so he's suddenly gone from someone that nobody knew he did this at all to someone who's created, you know, excitement where he is, to someone who suddenly finds himself having a regular exhibition at a commercial gallery. And the last email I had from him, inmates can email through a thing called Core Links. But in any case, this email saying, everything's changed. I think my future has opened. And he said, and I hope I'm big enough for it. You know, I think it's challenging him because he's got to be somebody worthy of his work. And up until now, and as he said, you know, money from this exhibition or anything that he sells is going to go into a two things, a restitution account, because he has some restitution to make for the crime. I don't know what it was. And a release account, because otherwise he'll get out at 61 with no special skills, modest education, African American, and guess what? As he said, I'll be on the streets. So I think that, I loved getting the email saying, I just hope I'm big enough for what seems to be happening. And I think he will be. I mean, he's really he's a nice person.
Well, and the art is wonderful.
Yep.
The art is just terrific.
It's stunning.
Tonan O'Connor, it has been such an honor having you in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure.
The Reverend Tonan O'Connor has been a practicing Buddhist since 1986. She began the Milwaukee Zen Center's prison ministry in 1998 and was the resident priest at the center from 2001 to 2011. The artwork of one of her incarcerated students, M. Winston, is part of the Inside Out show opening this Friday at the Portrait Society in the Third Ward. You can see photos of some of Mr. Winston's paintings at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.